Black Fist Fridays.
I mix what I like. What I like.
Nice to see you, Jared. I'll take the book on. Fully loaded.
I mix what I like.
Yeah.
What do you guys think about this Jared? He's nice, right?
No, he's pretty sharp.
Yeah, he does that no one else in the house can do.
Yeah, but he's a know-it-all. I mean, I don't think there's room in here for him.
Well, there will be after Richard gets rid of Big Head. He's a lightweight at everything. Brings nothing to the table.
But he's a great guy.
Great guy, but useless.
Yeah, he is a great guy. Not like that Jared. At least we can all agree on that.
Todd's my key to success. I think I'll spend more hours with Todd than even my parents. He's cool and he's smart, and that's why I named him Todd.
No, that makes sense.
I hate you. I hate you. I don't even know you. And I hate your guts. I hope all the bad things in life happen to you and nobody else but you.
What's up, African? Shout out to my real Africans out there.
What's up, world? Welcome to A Mix What I Like, special edition here at WPFW 89.3 FM. The whole crew plus is in effect. Hate's in the building, always.
Hate is always in the
building. Always in the building. Essie Ramu is in the building.
That cat, Essie Ramu, what up, what up?
What up? Dr. Mark Bolden's in the building. What up, dude?
Association of Black Psychologists, done some serious, serious work. So it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Dr. Ball.
About to have Dr. Todd Stephen Burroughs joining us from Newark, up there in New Jersey, in just a moment.
The Baraka Land.
The Baraka Land. I like that. New Baraka Land.
New Baraka.
New Baraka. I like that. I like that. He is on. Dr. Burroughs, good morning.
Good morning.
And tell us about, well, Red Eagle's on the boards.
Red Eagle's in the...
We got the superstar Chad in the building. Good morning.
What's up, family?
Baba 3.0 up in this piece.
We got 228 and 3.0. Ain't no half step in this
one. We living the life of pie up in this piece. Lions and tigers and Africans. And lionesses.
And lionesses. And lionesses. So, I guess true to form or true to fashion, the men have gathered. But in this case, to pay tribute to a specific woman, a lioness, as you just said. So why don't you set us up and tell us what Dr. Bolden has put together for us today.
Well, you know, Frances Cress Welsing is a psychiatrist extraordinaire. And if you think about the work that psychiatrists do, they try to make sense of the environment and work with people to get mental health. And Frances Cress Welsing has inspired a number of generations, particularly ours in the baby boom bap generation, with her book, The ISIS Papers, but really her stance on protecting African people by confronting white supremacy. So we want to honor her, and that's the only thing that could bring us back to the radio station to make sure that we participate in giving her the tribute and honor that she deserves as a queen mother. Somebody who's done the work for well over 40 years mm-hmm. in trying to explain this madness called white supremacy and its impact on the globe, not just for black people, but she started out talking about white supremacy and the impact of non-white people. So today we're going to hear from popular media. We're going to hear the tidbits that you've actually seen and heard from movies where Frances Cress Welsing is mentioned by name as she inspired filmmakers, comedians. And we're also going to hear from the scholars that she inspired, folks like T. Owens Moore, and really get into the discussion of That's melanin. Right. And I think for those of you in the D.C. area who have participated in the melanin conferences, you'll get the chance to hear this work and its continuation and proliferation for the next generations. And then for us, you know, it's always trying to bring about the expressions of hate. And so when we think about Fear of a Black Planet and Public Enemy, it's got to be this kind of show that we would pay tribute to Frances Cress Welsing, was saying she inspired Public Enemy, and we'll hear from Chuck D on his 20th anniversary of Fear of a Black Planet, the album extraordinaire by P.E., Public Enemy. So we got a lot to do today over the next couple hours. We'll be on from 10 to 12. We want to thank Atiyah Stitt for making this possible.
Absolutely.
And thank everyone else who's involved behind the scenes in making this possible. And if we get the chance, we'll also hear from Dr. Frances Cress Welsing's sister, Lorne, and have a rare interview that Lorne did with Dr. Cress back in the 70s, in the early iteration of WPFW. So we got a lot of history and people to cover, but
we got like you said, there's a lot to get into, and we're going to get into even some of the debate that has arisen post the passing of Frances Cress Welsing, where there's been a lot of online, in particular, back and forth about the meaning of her work. And from at least my perspective, there seems to be a great deal of misunderstanding about her work.
Right, the silent folks who wait until she dies to say something.
So we will address at least some of that as well. But I'm really glad you brought up this point, because that kind of goes to the point that you were making about her influence beyond what is even known to be her influence.
Sure.
And a lot of people either give her credit or rather reflect on her work without giving her credit. Mm-hmm. For a variety of reasons, but her work has had a major impact, continues to have a major impact in a lot of different areas, academic, journalistically, and artistically. So before we get back into the rest of the show, I think let's go ahead and take this quick transition, check out some of that influence, and then we'll be back with a lot more here at I Mix What I Like, the special edition of I Mix What I Like tribute to the late, great Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, right here on WPFW 89.3 FM. Don't go anywhere. Peace, everybody.
Where is Public Enemy?
What's the deal? What's your latest hit, brother?
Fear of a Black Planet.
Man, don't you worry about things. How's your daughter? Nope, she's not my type.
But suppose she says she loves me.
All your brain in a mix of black and white. Living in a land where the Lord say, mixing up race makes the blood impure. Yeah. She's a woman, I'm a man. Look at your face, I see you can't stand it.
Running,
but they got me on the run, tripping like I had a gun.
represent Parmesan. Consider me black to the bone. All I want is peace and love on this planet. Ain't how that God planned it.
I mix what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like.
My guest is Dr. Francis Welsing, a black psychiatrist, a prominent theorist in areas of racism, and a resident of Washington, D.C. She's the author of the Crest Theory of Color Confrontation, as well as a number of other papers on race-related issues in psychiatry. Dr. Welsing, first of all, I'd like to thank you for giving us this opportunity. And secondly, let me just start off by asking you how your work seems to differ and your theories somehow seem to differ in psychiatry from many other people. You seem to have stirred up quite a bit of controversy over the past few years with some rather new concepts about racism and its effect on black people and the treatment, from a psychiatric perspective, that black people might need in order to overcome many of the problems that they face. Why are these theories different, and what is your perspective on psychiatry?
Well, I think that the dominant thrust in psychiatry in the Western world for the past 50 years, certainly, has been based on the work of Sigmund Freud. And Freud was a Viennese gentleman who basically looked within the individual for the cause of the behavior problems. And his looking within the individual took him to what he referred to as a sexual instinct. And he saw behavior being a byproduct of the evolution or the development of the sexual instinct, or whether that instinct was thwarted, or how the sexual instinct was handled by the social situation. And that took the focus inside of the person to look for the origin of behavior pattern formation.
In other words, the problem stemmed within the individual.
Uh-huh. Right. Now, my work I see being distinctly different because my focus is external to the individual. My focus is on the power dynamic, the specific power dynamic that is external to the individual, and how that power dynamic acting on the genetic and constitutional makeup that the individual is brought into the world with, that is then impacted upon by the social dynamic as being the dominant determinant.
I'm going to have to ask you to translate that a bit, because I find that somewhat difficult to totally understand. In other words, your approach is one of that the external factor.
I don't look within the individual to find the cause of the behavior problem. I look to the various levels of the total social dynamic, beginning with, for example, I will look at, after I do a basic assessment of the genetic and constitutional makeup to make sure the individual, for example, is not mentally retarded and does not have brain damage or does not have some grave and serious problem that would interfere with nervous system function, because the nervous system is the basis for behavior pattern. It's the material base for behavior. If you don't have a nervous system, you're not going to end up with behavior. After looking at that, I look at the mother's personality, and then that mother's personality or the major caretaking individual's impact on the developing baby or infant, you know, after it comes home from the hospital. I then look at the father's personality as a distinct entity that begins an interacting process with the child. I then look at the mother-father relationship. Because you'll have a different kind of interaction. For example, if there's a father that's not present, that's going to have an impact on the child. If it's a male child that doesn't have a father image to follow, that's going to influence the behavior pattern. I then look at the beyond the mother and father interaction, whether there are other children in the family, what's the dynamic of the grandparents with the child, if those grandparents in particular are in the household. I then look at the immediate environment. What are the housing conditions that the child is brought into? The neighborhood conditions. What kind of income do the parents have? What kind of job does the father have? What kinds of schools are available? What kind of social institutions, church, recreation centers, etc., are available to help support the family in its work and caring for and socializing the child? And then beyond that, I look at what is the major power dynamic that is going on in the social system. And it's my analysis that the major power dynamic external to all that I have mentioned heretofore in this area of the world and throughout the world, and at this point in time and space, is racism. And my definition of racism is white supremacy. And so the power relationship of racism is white over non-white, meaning that you have white supremacy and non-white inferiority, or that the power that is in the world today rests in the hands of people who are classified as white, even though that white collective represents a tiny minority of the world's people. They still control the power at this point in time. They did not always control power, but at this point in world history, if you want to refer to it as that, they control and dominate the planet Earth. And that has grave implications, or certainly serious implications, for what is the pattern of institutional development within the system of racism that then begins to impact on all of the institutions, including the institution of the family. Racism, for example, has influenced patterns of employment available, employment opportunities available to black and other non-white people. And if we look at the black family in particular, it sets up a particular kind of job opportunity that is available to the black male as compared to the black female. Very often you have situations where black females can get jobs and black males cannot get jobs. And this has major determining impact on the ultimate behavior patterns that we're going to see in the newborn that is brought into that family, social system, community dynamic.
It seems to me to be, that should be actually a very natural approach. It would seem that that would be the approach that the majority of psychiatrists would take.
Well, I think no, because one of the problems that I feel that Western, and I guess I mean to say, if I'm not going to speak euphemistically, white psychiatrists and black psychiatrists who have been trained predominantly by white psychiatrists, the approach is to focus on the individual, because if you focus external to the individual, pretty soon you run into, you have to then do an analysis on what is the structure and the nature of the social system. And I believe that it's very difficult for many who are in the white collective, scientist or psychiatrist or whatever, to really dig deep into the dynamic of white supremacy. It's almost like holding the mirror flat up to your face and having to look at yourself and to do a very critical analysis of self. I think that the dynamic of racism that seeks to oppress whether that dynamic is conscious or unconscious, when it seeks to oppress the vast majority of the people on the planet Earth, it's a very ugly dynamic. It is a non-just dynamic. And for members of the white collective to look deeply into that issue, it becomes very painful. It's like self-criticism that they are not willing to do, because if they then probe deeply into their dynamic, it would imply the necessity to change themselves. And I think that this is very difficult to do, because my further understanding of racism, I view racism, I'll give you my definition of racism. Racism is a global behavioral system of logic, thought, speech, action, emotional response, and perception, whether consciously or unconsciously determined, the goal objective of which is white domination over people the whites have classified as non-white. These behavior patterns are conducted in all areas of people activity: economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war. The ultimate goal objective beyond white domination, the reason that white domination becomes a necessity for the white collective, is because they could be genetically annihilated by the vast majority of the people on the planet Earth. Meaning white, the skin whiteness is a genetic recessive state. It's a state of albinism. It can be genetically annihilated by people who have the genetic capacity to produce skin pigment. If white people had not worked out a system of behavior over time so as to control the majority of the people on the planet who are genetically dominant to themselves, they would disappear. So ultimately, racism is a means for white genetic survival on the planet. Do you see? So that the white behavioral scientists attempting to understand behavior patterns within the system of racism would then have to go into an analysis of racism. And the logic then would be, if it is producing serious disturbances in behavior, that you would have to change racism. But then if racism is changed, then there can't be white survival. Do you follow me?
So it's within the, according to your theory, it's within the interest, the actual physical survival of people who are classified or call themselves white to maintain a system.
Well, let's speak of genetic survival, okay, because genetic survival is a little bit different than physical survival. When I speak of the white global minority being genetically annihilated, they don't have to disappear, but they just won't be around as white people, or their offspring will not be white. So eventually you end up with no white people. This doesn't mean, this is quite different than physical annihilation brought about by a neutron bomb, for example. But the neutron bomb is methodology under the system of white supremacy to prevent their genetic annihilation by the non-white majority.
Then would you, to kind of digress a half a minute, since you've mentioned the neutron bomb, would you see that the idea or even the formulation or the consideration of such a bomb,
exactly, yes,
as a racist act, in a sense?
Well, remember that I said that racism was patterns of logic, thought, speech, action, emotional response, and perception, whether consciously or not.
Welcome back to WPFW 89.3 FM. I'm Jared Ball. Happy to be here with you once again for this special edition of I Mix What I Like, paying tribute to the woman you just heard speaking there, the late Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. The whole I Mix What I Like crew is in the building, plus some. We wanted to play that little bit of a classic WPFW interview with, I believe, her sister.
Her sister, Lauren Cress Love. And Lauren is going to join us on the air by phone a little bit later. She's organizing for the memorial tribute tomorrow. For those of you who haven't heard, there will be an actual memorial that was supposed to take place in January,
right
near the time of Dr. Cress Welsing's transition. It got snowed out, so it moved it closer to today, which is her birthday, March 18th. And the AME Church will be hosting between 1 o'clock and 4 o'clock tomorrow in Washington, D.C., the actual memorial, and it'll be broadcast. We'll give those details in a little bit. But let's get into some of the actual media influences that we've heard with Dr. Cress Wilson.
Right, so people got to hear a little bit there of a good, I think it was a good summary intro to her work and her perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And while I think it continues to make a lot of people uncomfortable and address issues in the world that aren't often focused on in this way, it has resonated very well within the communities, particularly Black communities around the world that have actually read and heard her present those ideas. She's also been, you know, there was a time where, I mean, it is kind of funny, and I know, you know, I know Ty can get into this here in just a second better than I can, but there appears to be pockets in American media history where room is made or has been made that doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
One of those examples was Phil Donahue. For instance, who was more recently removed from MSNBC at the reinvasion of Iraq in 2003 because they thought he was too radical. But in the 80s, I think he even started before that, but in the 80s in particular and into the 90s, his talk show was a platform in the context of mainstream media that was used very differently. And one of those, I believe, visits was, you know, well, Farrakhan would be there, but Cress Wilson, I believe, also appeared there.
Mm-hmm.
And that also helped spread her message and popularize her ideas. But within the Black community, they were all over the place.
Sure.
So we do have some clips we're going to play and some, but I don't know, Todd, if you want to get in on that and say a few more words, Chad, if you want to say a few more words about her engagement with.
Well, I want to take that media history piece, and the white versus Black socialization piece. Jared, you're 100% right about Phil Donahue, because Phil Donahue's show in the 70s opened the door for gay people to be on. Like, you know, back when homosexuality was a controversial issue to be discussed in American society, it opened up white feminists. I mean, all sorts of people were on the Donahue show because the Donahue show decided to discuss the issues of the society in the 1970s. And you're right, Farrakhan was on the show. Alice Walker was famously on the
show.
So Frances Cress Wilson goes into that context. The other thing you mentioned, I thought, was very important, because the reason that Frances Cress Wilson's ideas were all over the place was because we actually had Black political socialization then that was activist-based. So community activists would have study groups. There would be Black bookstores, and people would come into the Black bookstores and look around and learn, and there would be speakers and sidewalk speakers and news, Black news talk radio. So these kinds of intellectual, cultural, and political conceptions were part of Black America's DNA, because Black America was interacting with media and with activism and with organizing and with institutions that gave that information.
I hope people heard all that past tense in his description of what once was in the media.
You noticed that, huh?
But to hone in on the community institution, up in New York City, there was the First World Alliance, and
right
back in the days, I was a teenager and I was able to hear Dr. Wilson at that platform. But what's interesting is how much of a crowd she drew. They had to go to City College and rent out a separate space. And sometimes if you didn't get there in time, you had to go to another room and hear her via speaker. So that's the First World Alliance. And it was a big event when she came to New York City in the late 80s, early 90s.
Could you say a quick word about the First World Alliance? Because First World Alliance is a name, and the First World as part of people's titles of institutions and organizations gets some run, but there's some differences there, and this particular origin, I think, gets lost.
And if I may, I want to say that the origin of the First World Alliance is media connected, because it started when a group of activists, unless I'm wrong, it started when a group of activists saw Dr. Ben on Like It Is and asked him to come speak. Mm-hmm. And if I remember correctly, you know, he asked Dr. Clark to join him there, And that's how that began. That's the version I know.
That's the version I know, but
and on along that note, you know, I went as a teenager, and as a teenager, Dr. Ben would either open and Dr. Clark would close, or even vice versa. Dr. Ben would open it up and Dr. Clark would close it. So that would be and you had a sandwich of a whole bunch of scholars. But yeah, the First World Alliance was the fact that African people are the first people on the planet and
need an alliance.
Yeah, need an alliance. But it was a lecture series that came every Saturday on 145th Street. But again, Dr. Welsing was, you know, she was a real powerhouse. Every time it was sell out. So she was.
See, if we're doing this quick historical reflection, my first encounter with her work was in an article she had written in I believe 1970, and I was in the Navy, and I remember we were in the middle of the Red Sea participating in the bombing of Iraq, and Abdul Malik is his new name, Malik Abdul Assad, I think is the name he took. But this brother was one of the people that helped with my own political conversion. He passed me this article. And I remember she was talking about how hippies were growing their hair long and not bathing as a method of hiding their whiteness, of darkening themselves, trying to resist the imposed tendency or the tendency within white communities to want to promote their phenotype. These hippies were rejecting that, and their method of radicalism was to dirty themselves, to darken themselves, like, as much as possible. But anyway, again, this is I Mix What I Like, WPFW 89.3 FM, special 2-hour tribute to Dr. Francis Kress Welsing with the whole I Mix What I Like crew. Some of the work that Dr. Burroughs was just talking about, particularly, first let me just remind folks that they can hear the classic S.E. Ramu interview with both, and the only time that Kress Welsing and Dr. Marimba Ani were interviewed together.
It was the first time. Shout out to the Hunter clan, the marriage of Anoa and
that's right,
and Yofi brought Mama Frances Kress Welsing and Mama Marimba Ani together. And you know, when I saw that moment, when I saw that moment, I was like, can we
make it happen,
get this interview? So you'll see a picture from the wedding.
That's right.
Ashe.
And then you'll hear the actual interview with these two,
an extended conversation.
10 o'clock at night.
That's right.
Frances Kress Welsing said, We got to do this late after I see my clients. And so Mama Marimba was gracious enough to come there with the granddaughter. And we had the interview and let it roll. And that was surrounding the response to the murder and subsequent non-arrest of George Zimmerman. Right. Well, not murder of George Zimmerman. We can't think that prophetically. But the murder of Trayvon Martin and the subsequent non-arrest of George Zimmerman. And just trying to capture that moment with these two queen mothers. And a lot of folks have taken that audio and put it up without giving tribute. So we want to thank you, Dr. Ball, for actually posting that.
It's at imixwhatilike.org. People can and should check that out. And when they use it, attribute it appropriately to S.E. Ramu.
But can I back up and talk about institutions that were within the black community don't exist anymore? Was the fact that we had spaces like every time Spike Lee would do a book, he would write a... every time he would do a movie, he would write a book. And one of the films he did early on in his career was School Days. And it was a book that he wrote about School Days, on School Days. And in one part of the book, he talks about the great Larry Fishburne. Thank you. And Larry Fishburne has the cast and crew around listening to Dr. Fretz on audio. So the point that I wanted to make is that how these tapes, like the tape that you had, was distributed through the community.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Oh man, I'm telling you, I mean, the academic work I used to be involved in, some of the activist work I used to be involved in, all inspired by the mixtape and these lecture tapes that have gone all over the place. And created a whole new media and educational environment you know, outside of the school system. So big shout out to that. So speaking of all that, we're going to play this quick clip. Let another luminary, you know, someone we've already heard from this morning, Mr. Chuck D, and you know, rest in peace to his father and love and respect to his family. Chuck D's father passed not too long ago. You know, so, you know, shout him out as well. Bob Rhodes passed. We were going to add the tribute to him January. So shout out to him as well. And people can get that audio, some classic stuff from Bob Rhodes at imixwhatilike.org. Put together by our own, you know, Mr. Tom Porter, and others. So check that out as well. But let's play this quick clip, and then we are going to bring in, Miss Lauren Cress Love, and some other guests to talk more about the late Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. So don't go anywhere. Much more coming up right here at I Mix What I Like in WPFW 89.3 FM.
I mix what I like.
What's the deal?
What's your latest hit, brother? Fear of a Black Planet.
Playback.
Our freedom of speech is freedom of death. We got to fight the power. Don't be. Fight the power.
Coming off the heels of It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, the Bomb Squad, the whole thing was to come up with a whole different game plan. We wanted to go really with a deep, complex album that still resonated with a collection of singles from the last couple of years. And we also wanted to make an album that was more conducive to the highs and lows of a great stage performance. We took Dr. Francis Cress Welsing's color confrontation theory and condensed it into a recording. You know, telling people, well, color's an issue that's created and concocted to take advantage of people of various characteristics with the benefit of a few. How do you condense that in 1990 into a rap album when they think everything is infantile anyway? That was a challenge, you know. We met it with some sights and some sounds, and the beautiful aspect of that record, although we had Fight the Power and Welcome to the Terradome lead up into it, the first single on that record was 911 is a joke.
So get up and get shit down. 911 is joking, no town. Get up and get shit down.
You are here on I Mix What I Like. You may check us out on imixwhatilike.org, where you can see all these other shows and what my daddy likes and other cool things.
I Mix What I Like, back again, WPFW 89.3 FM. The whole crew is in the building. Just a little clip there of Chuck D talking about the impact of the late Dr. Francis Cress Welsing on his work. Got the full crew and more in the building for this, again, special tribute and special episode. Why don't you tell us what we got coming up next?
Well, first, I just got to say, like, if you think about Fear of a Black Planet, Welcome to the Terror Dome, right. Fight the Power, 911 is a Joke is the first single. Chuck is essentially saying, like, we start off with what we think about the police.
Yep.
Francis Cress Welsing's work, color confrontation, and ISIS papers would say the police use the guns as a neutralizer of genetic inferiority.
That's right.
And so you think about weapons in general from a warrior perspective. You think about the nightstick as this long black phallic symbol used to beat black folks. She was really dealing with how the cops are using symbols in order to deconstruct the power of black folks and then resurge and bring power to white folks. Back in the day when there really weren't that many black cops.
Mm-hmm.
And black cops, as we know, is an oxymoron. There's only black folks working for police who are serving the institution of white supremacy, right?
Can I just say real quick again that 911 is a Joke got me arrested as well. That song got me arrested back in the day. It was at a party. Somebody drove by playing it. I was out on the front porch singing it. And when the police raided the party, I was the only one to get arrested. And he was like 6'5". I was trying to run. I turned around. I'm like 6'2". And I turned around and ran into his chest. This dude was like 6'5", 6'6", 6'7".
RoboCop,
brick house white dude with his badge hanging around his you know, civilian clothing. And the only thing he said, so 911 is a joke, huh?
Mm.
And then they cuffed me, put me in a paddy wagon, by myself. It's like some 911. Yeah, I was like, yeah, it is a joke.
So 911 is a joke, and 9/11 was a conspiracy.
Wow, yes.
Fight the power.
Fight the power, baby.
Welcome to the hater dome, folks.
Welcome to the hater dome.
But to show love, we got Lauren Press Love on the line with us, and she is absolutely no stranger. She is a founder of this very station, WPFW, the first public affairs director. And you heard her voice in the interview with Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, her sister, back in 1970. So we want to welcome Lauren and just thank you for doing all the work that you've done. And we know you're busy getting prepared for tomorrow and that this is an exhausting, tiring moment for you. So we're really glad that you would join us on the show. Welcome back to the airwaves of PFW.
Well, thank you very, very much. If one believes that energy can never be killed and that we are all energy, I would first like to say happy birthday to my sister. Her loss is, for all of us, is tremendous. You know, I have not heard that tape between Fran and I. I've never heard it before. I mean, you know, we were on the air, but I never had an opportunity to sit back and listen to us and to listen to her in that way. And so I want to thank WPFW for, on Frances's birthday, doing this honor, doing this tribute. And I want to say to the audience, first of all, there's no station like WPFW. And the struggles that we, and I say we, went through to get the station on the air and to keep it on the air is a history in and of itself. But if anything that people hear today, if anything resonates, then I ask you to give a call to WPFW and make a pledge of support to keep this station on the air and to keep these voices heard, not just my sister, but all the voices, a different frame of reference that is so much needed. So if this is not, this may not be Pledge Week or whatever.
I don't
whatever.
Think it's ever not Pledge Week right here.
Right. But I urge people to support WPFW. So now, what was your question? And I must say, you may not know and the audience may not know, but, and maybe I shouldn't even say this, but I will say it. We have another sister, oldest of three girls. Frances died on the 2nd of January, and our other sister died on the 20th of February. So I have lost both my sisters within about a month. And so, just personally, this is the first time I have said this publicly, but this is, you know, like two-thirds of my life is gone. So if I sound somewhat cheery, because it's Frances's birthday, and listening to her in this interview, I don't even remember when we did this, but just listening to her genius and understanding her courage and her strength to stand up against the naysayers and those who would say, oh, she's crazy, or I don't understand what she's talking about, or how dare her, et cetera, et cetera. The courage that it took over these years to maintain her ideas and to maintain her sense of truth is invaluable.
We definitely appreciate those. Well, first of all, we appreciate you taking the time to join us. We appreciate the work that you've done, and we certainly send our condolences to your family and appreciate you working through that with us as well.
And I want to add, Lauren, you've done a lot of work with PFW. But you also have a background in SNCC. So if we got a SNCC rider and Mama Frances Cress Welsing, I want to just honor your parents and the folks that raised y'all for raising such warrior queen sisters.
Absolutely.
So what was going on in your household when you were growing up? Like, you had target practice in the back, boxing lessons, how not to be a punk growing up. It didn't sound like the Jack and Jill home where you got the debutante training. You were like, this is resident dissident home number one.
Oh, no, no. I have not really thought about our background in very much. I haven't really sat down and thought, well, how did we get formed? And recently I've been asked this question a couple of times. And I would just, if you don't mind, I would just take you back. Frances is the third physician in our family. And our father was a physician. And our grandfather was a physician, and who died in 1909. So you can imagine when he got trained, and he was trained in Chicago. He was from North Carolina, and his father came to Chicago and worked to help send him through medical school. Now, we never knew him. As I said, he died in 1909, and so for many, many, many years, up until around the 70s, all we knew about him was what my grandmother, his wife, told us. And she told us that he was what was called at that time a race man. And that was a term that was used at the turn of the century and then somewhat beyond to describe people and men who worked for the race, who fought and struggled for the race. And our grandmother always said that he fought harder and spent more time fighting for the race than he did practicing medicine. But that was all that we knew. We didn't really know very much about his views. He was a contemporary of Ida B. Wells, who also was in Chicago. And in the 70s, my grandmother gave us some papers, and there were not a lot of them, but papers that he had written. And in these papers was a menu. This was highly decorative. It was a menu from a dinner that was given for our grandfather by other African Americans in the Chicago community to honor him. And in this little menu was a handwritten note. And I can't quote it exactly, but what it said, and it was on some lined paper, and it was like something that was torn, you know, or taken from a larger piece of paper. And what it was saying, that this is not the exact quote, but what it meant was, if you can assure me that you will not lose your head like so many others have, I can assure you the support of the women. Well, this had to, and so this was written in pencil on a piece of paper, blue lined. This had to have come from Ida B. Wells, because she was the only woman on the committee that gave this dinner for our grandfather. Now, just as an aside, we grew up in Chicago. Ida B. Wells' daughter, Alfreda Duster, was a good friend of my mother's, who was a Chicago public school teacher. And her children, the Duster family, went to school with us, Frances and me and my sister Barbara. There were about five of them, and some are deceased now. Troy Duster is a noted sociologist and on the faculty of Stanford, I understand, and also in New York. He's the youngest of the Duster clan, and they are the grandchildren of Ida B. Wells. So that's just an aside. But we, so I'm just sharing that as part of history and, you know, something about Chicago and Chicagoans and, but,
Let me yes. pause you there because,
let me interrupt you just real quick, just remind people.
And then Chad, interrupt him.
Right, interrupt me, and then somebody try to interrupt you. This is WPFW 89.3 FM, our Mix What I Like, and we're listening to the sister of the late Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, Lorne Cress Love, talking with us about her work and her family's history. And so I just wanted to lay that out real quick before we moved on, but please go ahead, yeah.
You know, when you hear Dr. Cress Welsing and you see her, like I saw one image of her and I was like, she looks like the re-enlivenment of Queen Tai. Mm. She just has a royal dignity about her, but she also always walked tall. And when you talk about Chicago, I just think about the hardiness of folks from the Midwest dealing with them cold winters and them cold white folks out there. But she also had a coolness about her. Like when you see that debate in 1974, it wasn't really a debate in the Clark sense. It was all others I teach. Right. You only debate your equals. She was teaching Shockley about how wrong his racist views were. She understood him, right? And she's wearing that Garvey red, black, and green sweater. So she, you can see the race woman in her. But she was calm. I want to know the stories behind the scenes. Did you all ever get back together and be like, did you see what I did to that white boy in that interview? Did she ever boast or brag about some of the stuff she did?
No, not in that way at all.
How would she talk about it? Because I'd be slapping fires like, we're going to end white supremacy today.
Well, first of all, Frances, as you know, took her work extremely seriously. And I have said more recently to people that many other people knew Frances in a way that we, her family, did not, because she left Chicago when she graduated from high school in 1951 and went to Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And actually, for all intents and purposes, that was, she left Chicago. Now, of course, she returned, you know, for holidays, spring break, this and that. But essentially, she stepped out into the world away from her family, in that sense, away from Chicago, in 1951. Now, she, of course, we talked all the time, but she did not go into great detail about what she said, how she said it, in that way at all. No. She may have, and I remember that Shockley debate, and I remember the one up in New York where neither Frances nor Shockley were permitted to speak. But, I mean, because of the uproar in the audience and the people shouting down and really essentially shouting down Frances. But she was not braggadocious about her theory or her presentations. Our mother was a school teacher, and so Frances probably at one level very unconsciously saw herself as a teacher. It was her obligation. You know, our father was a physician, and so she saw her obligation as a healer, as was our grandfather. And if people believe in that we do come back, then I have more recent years thought that Frances was channeling our grandfather, Dr. Henry Clay Cress, who was a race man, who fought for the race, and who died at a very unfortunate early age of pneumonia. So we didn't know him. But here, a generation jump a generation, and here he comes again. You know, people can take that for whatever. It depends on what your belief system is. But you were asking about how we were raised. Even though our parents were professional people, we were never taught to think that that made us different. You know, we lived in a black community of that time where everybody lived together. So the professional people and the non-professional people and even very, very poor people back in the 30s and 40s and even into the 50s lived together. We lived on 3149 Ellis, which was a house that our maternal grandparents, grandfather bought in 1909. And we lived there until the 40s when we were forced out of that neighborhood, which was the first major gentrification or attempt at gentrification in the nation, when they just tore down the whole community and forced the black people out. Now, they have more refined ways of doing that now. It's called gentrification. But back in the 40s, we were, our family and many others were the first black generation. Let's say outside of Africa, okay? Let's say outside of Africa.
And then after the indigenous Americans of this country.
Exactly.
All of the extermination
exactly,
wars.
Exactly. So in terms of African Americans, that happened to it. And that was a very painful, painful, emotionally painful process for our family and for our mother, who absolutely just hated to have to move and to lose her community. So, but we did have some special opportunities just because our parents were professional people. We were not a wealthy family, and my father actually did not know that he was supposed to make money as a doctor. I mean, he didn't believe that, really. We were, you know, he was a healer, but he did not see himself as using this field as a means of taking the family to a higher level of income. It really, you know, my daddy treated people. He just treated people. I remember one time some people coming to the house with this man who had been stabbed, and the man laying on our living room floor, fortunately it was not carpeted, and this man bleeding, and my father just working on him, because that's what a doctor did. You know, that's what a doctor did. And in more recent years, so many of my friends, and especially males, have talked about how my father helped them. I mean, when we were in high school, nobody ever told us this, but they would go and talk to him, I guess, maybe about issues of sex, maybe about issues, whatever issues males need to talk to another male about. But our mother was so community, so community involved. She taught Chicago Public Schools for 45 years. When she retired, then she continued to educate children and had children and in the house and teaching them to read and giving them books. And she had a campaign called Keep Chicago Clean. And she had her own buttons made. Now, Frances has had buttons made, and Frances, one of her 10 stops is to stop throwing down trash in neighborhoods in your community where black people have to live, work, and play. And that was one of my mother's slogans, not specifically those words, but my mother said, keep Chicago clean. She had her own buttons made. And when she died at 93 at her funeral, we gave our buttons, keep Chicago clean, because that, you know, in her memory and in her honor.